Get this one right on Wednesday, the 6th of September, a parliamentary sitting day. Thank you for listening to The Anarchist World this week. Listen in next week on your local community radio station. And remember, if you do nothing, nothing will ever change. Run away from your computer. Run away from your couch. Join us in the struggle to create an egalitarian community on this continent. Thank you. Listen in. Anarchist World this week, next week on the Community Radio Network.
Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction.
An analysis you'll never hear anywhere else. Anarchist World this week, Australia's sacred cow slaughterhouse. 10 a.m. every Wednesday. Listen to The Anarchist World this week for an up-to-date analysis of local, national and international events.
Poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
On the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
I'm not a mob lawyer, okay? I'm not a hired gun. I'm someone who has spent their entire life, whether as a social worker, a community organizer, an activist, a legal aid lawyer in the South Bronx, an international human rights lawyer, and a prisoner. I'm not someone who has, you know, ever compromise core values and principles in pursuit of whatever the end may be. So people have to make decisions on who they are and how they're going to lead and live their lives. That's it.
This is Rebecca Pierce. I'm a journalist and filmmaker from the San Francisco Bay Area. You can find me at weirdsister.tv, and this is Aboriginal Radio.
Okay, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. This is the Angry Indian. Thanks for sitting in. Today we have Stanley Cohen in the virtual studio. He is a North American attorney at law, well known if not infamous for defending contentious social justice issues and human rights / anti-colonial causes occurring in the United States and occupied Palestine. He was raised by Orthodox Jewish parents and attended Hebrew schools. He has represented members of the Hamas and Hezbollah governments, relatives of Osama bin Laden, and the Sheikh accused to be the mastermind behind the World Trade Center attack in 1993. Aside from defending world actors, a number of other clients close to home have also used the services. The Legal Aid Society, I believe somewhere in New York, the Winnebago, Omaha, and San Francisco nations have as an advisor doing the anti-poverty programs as a VISTA volunteer. He has worked alongside the late William Kunstler and late Vince Stewart. In 2014, he pled guilty to many say questionable federal tax violations, obstruction, filed tax returns, and he was sentenced to 8 months, resulting in the suspension of his law license. As quoted in an article by Jessica Schulberg for the New Republic, Mr. Cohen calls it an honor to be voted as the world's number one safe, healthy Jew. And we asked him here to Fall Fort Radio to discuss the rise of fascism in the United States under the Trump administration, the silence of the Zionist movement in regards to the J-Folia within the Trump White House, and how this relates to the colonial situation that is going down in Israel / occupy Palestine. And I also thought it would be important to have him here to discuss the undue pressure that many human rights activists in the U.S. and Canada are facing now when we speak about certain subjects, in particular the issue in occupied Palestine, because that there was a law passed some years ago in Israel to actually prosecute people for defending BDS, boycott, investment, and sanctions. And now they are really, really trying to press that here, where even to discuss it on the college campus, in your place of employment, you can be prosecuted. So having said that, Stanley Cohen, welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Oh, cool. Thanks. Just one correction. I did not lose my law license. It was suspended, and this suspension is about to expire, and I'll soon be back in the courtrooms fighting the fight.
Okay, so that's good to know. Stand correct. Thank you on that. My first question is a pretty obvious one. We saw what happened in Charlottesville. I mean, there's been a lot that led up to Charlottesville. We have many prominent Jews, in particular Stephen Miller, grandson of immigrants. Like my mother, his grandparents spoke Yiddish. What is going on here when we see the sort of, I mean, he's been giving blanket, praise to the far right. I mean, how are we supposed to deal with this after 8 years of the Obama?
Well, look, Miller is dysfunctional in every aspect of his life. He has manifested overt fascist tendencies and supremacist racist views of the universe since he was in grammar school, from what I understand. He is very much a dysfunctional, perfect follower of the lunacy of the right, always has been, and finds himself at the ripe age of 30 or 31, inexperienced, uneducated, unsophisticated, and a raving racist. I think what's fascinating that it's had to develop is that, for years, there has been a struggle to separate the notion of Judaism being the enemy, but rather it being very clearly Zionism and the State of Israel. And that the attempt by the State of Israel to proclaim that it speaks on behalf of world Jewry was a grand exercise in obfuscation, exaggeration, and distortion, designed to almost draw Jews into this blind, obedient support worldwide for genocide based upon race, religion, ethnicity, heritage, and land. And what I find to be paradoxical in the extreme is the fact after years and my brothers and sisters in Palestine and the Arab and Muslim world agree with this, of successfully segregating, separating the notion that Judaism and Zionism are one and the same. We now have I hate the word alt-right because it whitewashes supremacist, ugly Klan and neo-Nazi hatred. It cleans it up for public consumption, but we now have that same group that, interestingly enough, have gone on the rip and plunder directed at Jews at the same time that they support the State of Israel. So it's come full circle, and when people say to me, well, how can they support the State of Israel? And it's very fundamental, because there's scant distinction between white supremacists or Zionist supremacists, between the Zionist community in the United States and its supporters, such as the Bannons, the Millers, and the Gorkhas, and the Netanyahu government, which has not only built, crafted, and daily reinforced a racist regime, one of apartheid and ethnic cleansing and occupation and genocide, but has broken bread with some of the world's leading, most notorious fellow travelers, including General Sisi in Egypt, breaking bread increasingly with the royal family in Saudi Arabia, making inroads with a regime that I consider to be very much one of the world's leading violators of human rights in Russia and in the United States. So it's interesting that after all these years, at the end of the day, you have power breaking bread with power. You have supremacists becoming consumed with one issue and one issue alone, and that is basically the sale of a particular race, a particular political view, and a particular drive to control the military-industrial complex and output of the quote-unquote developed and emerging worlds.
You know, one of the things that really confuses me about a lot of this is that when I look at Stephen Miller and then how he could sit next to someone like Stephen Bannon, or how he could sit in the same room with Sebastian Gorka, who, if I remember correctly, he was actually an active member of a Hungarian far-right party that discussed liquidating their Jewish population, but they couldn't understand, you know, they were trying to figure out which way they were going about it and couldn't come to an agreement, and that's pretty much why it didn't go down. When we see this from A. Foxman at the ADL or any number of Jewish representatives in the mainstream media, whether they're in the Republican or the Democratic Party, why is it that no one has pointed out the clear fascist elements? You know, we're talking about the Klan a lot, and like you said, this all...
Well, it's simple, because the white supremacists, and it's interesting that, you know, even national socialist movements in Europe, they've now embraced this notion that there's something inherently evil or perverse about identity politics and a distortion of what identity politics is all about, have broken bread around the issue of identifying the good fight and the bad. That Bannon and Gorka and Miller and Trump and Netanyahu and national socialists worldwide would sit and break bread should come as no surprise, because ultimately at the end of the day, it really is not about religion. It really is about power. It's about economic power. It's about racial supremacy. It's about political control. It's about reshaping the existence of a developing world which poses increasingly a threat to them. Let's not forget that, you know, the world, as large as it is, has grown smaller day by day. And that people that were very much colonialized, oppressed, limited in their reach, their ability to travel, to get access to fellow travelers, to communicate, to gain education and freedom, are increasingly involved in self-determination movements and struggles worldwide. That threatens a 200-400 year period of colonial and neo-colonial control that is at the heart of this. People like Miller, and you know, it's interesting because the ADL can jump up and down all day long and take offense by the Jews will not replace us or the monkeys are coming to get us, at the same time that they wholeheartedly support ethnic cleansing and genocide in Palestine. So you see people that are rolled out on media at night during the height of Charlottesville that are offended by anti-Semitism, which is also an interesting notion because, you know, most of the Jews are Ashkenazi and not Semitic people, and anti-Semitism really deals with hatreds of Arabs or perhaps Sephardic Jews. But they roll out this collective of people that with righteous indignation speak from on high about the inherent evil of ethnic, racial, religious supremacy and cleansing, but yet embrace it, support it, fund it, and applaud it in Palestine. So there is this neat little clean demarcation of Bantu stands. And it's interesting because it wasn't, I wrote a piece for Counterpunch about a year ago that spoke about this sort of same event in the civil rights movement down south in the 60s, where northern Jews came down and very much there's this romantic notion decades later that they saved the day. When for, you know, attacks on Jim Crow, challenge on Jim Crow, the struggle against slavery even before the Civil War had always been led, and there were abolitionists, of course, northern liberals and progressives that were involved, but was always a movement of color about people of color fighting to free people of color. But the enlightened, quote-unquote, liberal Jewish community in the North tried to come down and take credit. And so what I see now often happening is you've got Reform Jewish synagogues and rabbis and activists in New York City, and I'm not going to, you know, criticize Jewish Voice for Peace in particular because it's a strong movement in support of Palestinian liberation. But you see others that speak about civil rights and talk in terms of fundamental notions of equality and justice that are race blind, that are religious blind, that are based upon equality and humanity, but yet somehow segregate the chosen people, for lack of a better word, when it comes to Israel in its imperial control in its apartheid system in Palestine. Justice is justice. It's racist, religious, it's politically blind. Liberals, you know, this whole debate, and I'm in the midst of writing a piece right now where I'm going to challenge some people who I've respected, and it doesn't matter, I'm not going to name them by name, for years, but this ongoing debate now about how Antifa is playing into the hands of supremacist organizations by serving as an excuse to defend the racist genocide or to attract new members to their calling is so much fence-sitting and it's delusional. It's very simple. Everyone has a fundamental right to free speech, and I've been a free speech proponent and litigator for 40 years. And everyone has a fundamental right to knock someone purporting to support genocide on their ass. This notion that, you know, armed struggle or resistance or militant resistance to offensive conduct, to lynching, to ramming, to the presence of weapons, that people must go silently under the night is not what the First Amendment talks about at all. And for fence sitters who believe that somehow it soils this pure history and notion of free speech, well, that's not what free speech has been about. Because if you impose majoritarian value on speech, especially when it comes to a history based upon racial supremacy, Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and Black Lives Matters are silenced. They are silenced by the tyranny of the majority. The notion that we are a democratic institution is we are a democracy in terms of our electoral process. We are a 250-year-old republic that has had some very dark moments. But ultimately, a republican form of government stands for a very simple principle. It is to protect the minority from the tyranny of the majority. And at times that's done by pure free speech. And at other times, historically, people like John Brown have stood up and Malcolm X and said, that's fine, but the Constitution is not a suicide pact. So this notion that people that resisted and that defended in Charlottesville or in Boston or in Berkeley or in a dozen other cities to come here and abroad have to somehow light a candle and chant and sing Kumbaya, otherwise somehow their message is lost or their momentum is tarnished, is just so much status quo. I mean, the late, great Saul Alinsky, who was an organizer for Martin Luther King, once stated in response to a question of, you know, what's the definition of a liberal, said that, you know, a liberal is one who stomps their foot down in righteous indignation in thin air. You know, everyone supports fundamental rights to clothing and feeding and education and health. Those are the easy issues. When it comes to issues in which people challenge institutional racism, classism, militarism, capitalism, greed, exploitation, the sale of people based upon race, culture, religion, and history, and it forces people to identify and attack, and at times in a militant way, you know, long-accepted core misvalues, I call them, is a much different challenge. Now, I believe very firmly that each generation is entitled to chart the course of the future of the world they are to inherit. And I believe very strongly in the right of the young women and men that are in the streets right now resisting and challenging supremacy, hatred, and racism, and the Klan, and neo-Nazis. That's their call to make. Now, there may be a price to pay, as Frederick Douglass said, power never concedes anything without struggle. It may be a moral struggle, it may be a physical struggle, but a struggle it must be. And of course, there's a price to pay. I'm not suggesting that people who cross the line from pure speech into action get a free pass, because the most principled people in American and world history who have taken courageous, often militant stands have paid dearly, often with their lives, routinely with their liberty, their reputation. Prisons in America and throughout the world are filled with political dissidents, with writers, with activists, with poets, with photographers, with journalists, with community organizers, with opposition leaders, who are united by their resistance to the status quo and their willingness to sacrifice, at times all, in the name of justice and equality.
I really wanted to go into the question of Antifa, which is short for the anti-fascist movement, because there is no such animal. There is no such group called Antifa. There is no such thing as the alt-left. But one of the things I wanted to bring up really quick before we take a break is Noam Chomsky. Now, he surprised a lot of people here a couple of days ago. At least it's just come to my attention on libcom.org that he is slamming Antifa, which I'm actually not surprised about, but it surprised quite a few of the people around me who consider themselves to be liberals slash progressives, because they really thought that he was supporting. And he pretty much enunciated what you were talking about in terms of you're giving the far right an excuse now by coming like this, despite the massive evidence that the police were also assaulted by the far right protesters in Charlottesville and did not respond. We already know the New York Times has codified this, and the man is now in custody, who fired at a black protester and, you know, in front of police, went right past the police. They didn't intervene. They didn't do anything. I mean, there were all sorts of beatings and so on. And, you know, Trump has repeated and parroted this message. But when somebody like Noam Chomsky speaks against something like Antifa, especially when he has written in defense of Robert Flores' song. And we all remember the fallout that happened behind that, even though those of us who understand free speech understood his position. For him to come out against Antifa, as a political activist, as an international political activist that deals specifically with human rights issues and specifically with the resistance to those human rights violation. How would you define a statement like that, or at least a suggestion from Noam Chomsky that the anti-fascist movement is making a mistake, knowing the weight that he has amongst progressives, amongst what is left of the political left in the United States?
Well, there's a couple of ways. Number one, and as I said, I'm working on a piece right now that talks about if you've never spent time in the streets, you are not in a position to judge or decide the nature and scope of the streets. I respect Noam for years, because for years he was forefront in the struggle, liberation struggle throughout the world. And let me engage, I'm no longer a kid myself, so let me engage with what some may determine to be a statement of ages. And, you know, Noam is 86 now. He's fought a long fight for a good time. I'm not at all surprised. He's opposed to BDS. He's a supporter of the two-state solution, which I do not support and have never supported. I think he is, to some degree, like others that have written upon this, and, to some degree, the changing nature of resistance, the changing nature of the enemy, the changing nature of multinational struggle, oppression, and resistance has, I'm not going to say passed them by, but is a difficult notion to form fit into a life that has generally remained consistent in one direction. I'm going to, you know, I disagree with Noam completely on this point. I think if you were to ask Chomsky how history might have been different in the 1930s, the early 30s, if there was an anti-fascist movement involved in militant resistance in Germany, how much different the world would have been. The notion that an anti-fascist movement could engage in vigorous militant resistance and be glorified, as they should be, in Spain against the fascists, but yet now should not, is a bit of a disconnect. And I don't worry at all. Look, the Klan, neo-Nazis, and white supremacists attract a very distorted, dysfunctional, hate-driven segment of our society. The notion that somehow they would attract celebrity, support, or new membership by militant resistance to them says more about a number of people that are dysfunctional in our society than it does the righteousness of their position. So, you know, Noam has spoken about it. I disagree completely. I think to go silently into the night is to be complicit, is to invite, especially given the politics of this time, horrific repression, even more dangerous than now. You know, I did some research yesterday and I posted something on Twitter of the, you know, the 4,700 to 4,800 lynchings between 1882 and 1968. I couldn't find anyone attributed to the anti-fascist movement or its precursors. And of the, you know, 100, 200, 300,000, depending upon what you consider hate crime events in the last year or two or three in the United States based upon race, religion, creed, ethnicity, or politics, I couldn't find a single one laid at the feet of anti-fascists. So I'm not going to join that safe chant that's coming from the liberals and from some progressive icons to suggest that the only means of resistance against the ugliness that is the Klan and white supremacists and the neo-Nazis is petition drives or to invoke hate legislation, because today hate legislation can be directed at the Ku Klux Klan or neo-Nazis, and tomorrow it can be done at the Antifa or BLM. People have a right to self-determination. People have a right to, in certain experiences, armed struggle. People have a right to militant resistance. People have a right to self-defense. It is an evolving situation that depends upon the nature of the struggle and the forces against whom they struggle. And I'm not going to draw this crystal line in the sand that free speech require is a suicide pact. I believe that it's very clear under 250 years of First Amendment jurisprudence that there is a difference between speech and action brigaded in speech. When the Ku Klux Klan comes marching down the road with torches burning, screaming what they're screaming, carrying AR-15s, Glocks, attacking people with brooms, running people down with cars, firebombing mosques, lynching people in 2017 because there's at least one lynching that has not yet been resolved, I am not going to take the position that the answer is to light a candle and to chant Kumbaya.
Yeah, and, you know, that's the discussion that, you know, is out there on the street. You know, people are wondering, now that Sheriff Joel Pyle has been pardoned before he was even sentenced for clearly violating the law in terms of racial profiling, people are really, really afraid. And we're going to take a break. You're listening to Stanley Cohen, American lawyer. We're going to continue to discuss the rise of fascism in the United States, how this relates to Occupy Palestine and fascism as it pops up in other places. I'm the Angry Indian, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please, stay tuned.
This is Samantha Nock at Samiri on Twitter, at halfbreedsreasoning.wordpress.com, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, healthcare, including reproductive health, was women's business and respected as such. Reclaim your healthcare choices by keeping yourself informed and sharing information with your relatives. Inform yourself about Plan B, known as the morning after pill. Plan B will protect you from becoming pregnant after a sexual assault or unprotected sex if taken within 72 hours. Make sure your local Indian Health Service facility carries Plan B. It does not require a prescription and should be provided upon request. It's your right. For more information, call your local healthcare facility. This message is brought to you by Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
The I'm going to stand until I can't stand no more if I have to stand by myself.
The American people are the last people to wake up.
Prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy.
People of color organize critical thinking, strategic work, and direct action for social, racial, gender, and economic justice.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
People of Color Organize features intersections of race, politics, feminism, movement, class, internationalism, and theory.
This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about all of us.
Visit us online at peopleofcolororganize.com. Follow us on Twitter at POC Organize and Facebook at facebook.com/peopleofcolororganize. You can also find us on Tumblr at peopleofcolor.tumblr.com.
We're organizing against what we term genocide.
Missy Elliott for the Black AIDS Institute.
HIV happens to us more than it does anybody else, which is why we should all get tested, because if we don't step up, then nobody will.
Get informed, get tested, get treated, and get involved. For more information, call the Black AIDS Institute at 213-353-3610. That's 213-353-3610. Or online at www.blackaids.org.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
I'm your host, Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. Think you're going to like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/fightingcockfire.
In articles acknowledging the one-year anniversary of the assault on Gaza, blunt and unsparing language is rare. Despite sympathy and support for the Palestinian people, the description of what took place in January 2009 is sometimes buffered by a misguided sense of political correctness. Yes, it's terrible. Yes, it is unjust. But we don't want to be inflammatory or risk offending the sensitivities of those who, through their own willful ignorance, cling to the notion that Israel is a victim state, fighting for its very survival. This commentary is more forthright. Gaza, in plain language. The sociopathic Zionist administration of Israel, as part of its continuing brutal colonization of Palestine, deliberately devastated the already nearly incapacitated infrastructure which supports the existence of 1.5 million refugees. The people of Gaza, second, third, and fourth generation dispossessed Palestinians, are living in forced exile from land their families inhabited and cultivated for generations. Half of them are children under the age of 15. Their culture and their economy has been systematically ravaged by Israel for decades, and since 2006, a criminal siege, supported by the United States, as well as much of the international community, has deprived them of all but the most minimal resources for subsistence. This oppressed and brutalized population was bombed, bulldozed, and terrorized mercilessly for 23 days. What follows is a small sampling of facts concerning the barbaric actions which one of the most powerful military machines in the world took against a captive and defenseless population. If the reality presented here goes beyond the stretch of your imagination, you can verify the data yourself with a few simple Google searches. Though you'd better hurry, much of this information seems to be disappearing down Google's memory hole, just as is the fate of the people of Gaza. You may discover that exact figures vary somewhat depending on the source, but whether it was 21,000 structures or 22,000 structures destroyed, whether 280 schools were destroyed or badly damaged versus 230, the overwhelming truth of the physical devastation which took place in Gaza and the fact that this destruction was deliberate and premeditated is irrefutable. Even the Goldstone Report, itself a document with severe pro-Zionist overtones issued by a declared Zionist and a supporter of Israel, states unequivocally, "The deliberate actions of the Israeli forces and the declared policies of the government of Israel cumulatively indicate the intention to inflict collective punishment on the people of the Gaza Strip in violation of international humanitarian law." We've heard time and again that more than 1,400 Palestinians were killed, over 80% of them civilians, including 342 children. These figures have become a familiar talking point in discussions of last year's assault, so much so that they may have lost their impact. But what we are not often reminded of is the horrific level of carefully planned destruction of civilian infrastructure in Gaza, orchestrated by Israel during Operation Cast Lead. Financed and armed by the United States, the Israeli military destroyed 15% of the structures in Gaza. Approximately 22,000 buildings, including 5,300 housing units, destroyed or subject to major damage. Another 52,000 homes received some form of structural damage. Over 200 factories and 700 stores and businesses were destroyed or badly damaged. Of the residences, factories, and businesses completely destroyed, 1,300 of the homes and approximately 25% of the commercial property were deliberately and painstakingly bulldozed or exploded by Israeli ground forces. 8 hospitals and 26 primary health care clinics were damaged or destroyed. More than 280 schools were damaged or destroyed. Water and sewage treatment facilities, as well as electricity infrastructure, were deliberately targeted, leaving vast segments of the population with little or no power or clean water for the duration of the assault and for weeks and months to follow. Massive amounts of agricultural lands were systematically bombed or bulldozed.
When the Israelis invaded the Gaza Strip, they came straight in here. I've covered earthquakes, hurricanes, and the tsunami. And what has happened here is as bad or worse than anything I've seen in any of those. And this was done by Israeli bulldozers.
Some estimates suggest that as much as 80% of the arable land in Gaza has been ruined or declared off-limits to the people of Gaza over the last decade. 2 million liters of wastewater from Gaza City's sewage treatment plant, bombed during the assault, leaked into surrounding agricultural land, making it unusable. An Israeli television station boasted that Israeli warplanes alone, without accounting for tank, ground troop, and warship ammunition, dropped approximately 1,000 tons of bombs on Gaza during Operation Cast Lead. The effort involved months, if not years, of carefully considered target selection, giving the lie to any claim that the devastation was incidental.
We are trying to avoid any kind of civil casualties.
Zaitun, also flattened by Israeli bulldozers. But in this house, they'd herded 100 members of the Samuni clan, and then they shelled it, killing 49 of them.
We are trying to avoid any kind of civil casualties.
It requires a stunning level of denial and self-delusion to pretend that the destruction which was achieved in Gaza had anything to do with Israel's security or the targeting of Hamas militants. This was savage and barbaric collective punishment unleashed on a civilian population, nothing less. Any suggestion to the contrary must be sharply and immediately ridiculed as absurd. This was arguably the first aerial bombing campaign ever conducted on a defenseless civilian population held captive within a fenced enclosure and not allowed to escape the assault. It is a measure of the cynical mindset of the Israeli military that leaflets were sometimes dropped in neighborhoods about to be bombed, suggesting the residents flee. "We are about to destroy your home. You had better get out." "Flee to where? Gazans are not allowed to leave their open-air prison, not even when under attack." This tactic on the part of Israel also gives the lie to the claim that homes and buildings were targeted because there were Hamas militants hiding inside them. Why then warn them to leave before destroying the structures? Given this litany of horror and the coldly premeditated nature of its execution, we must ask, What kind of society condones this level of brutality? What precedent is there for such monstrous disregard for the basic tenets of human decency? Unfortunately, we need look no further than the behavior of the United States, Israel's staunch supporter and mentor. In Iraq, the toll of U.S. militarism is well over a million lives, and a large part of the infrastructure of a nation of 26 million people has been ruined. And what of Gaza today, 1 year later? Israel's continued illegal siege, enabled by the United States and the U.S. client state, Egypt, has prevented any substantial amount of building material from entering Gaza. Essentially, no reconstruction has been possible. The people of Gaza live amidst the rubble created by Israeli hatred and aggression. They are attempting to rebuild their communities using mud bricks and whatever can be salvaged from the wreckage. The next time someone argues Israel has a right to defend itself or attempts to use the abusive spouse defense, look what you made me do.
They are forcing us to kill their children to defend our children.
Tell them no. Tell them there can never be any acceptable justification for the deliberate devastation of an entire society. It is unconscionable. It is wrong. Plainly put, there is no sane argument in favor of such behavior. Those who believe there is should be rebuked and must be vigorously opposed.
Stalin wasn't stolen when he told the Beast of Berlin that they'd never rest contented till they had driven him from the land. So he called the Yanks and English and proceeded to extinguish the Fuhrer and his vermin. This is how it all began.
Now the devil he was reading in a good book one day how the Lord created Adam to walk the righteous way, and it made the devil jealous. He turned green up to his horns, and he swore by things unholy that he'd make one of his own. So he packed two suitcases full of grief and misery, and he caught the midnight special going down to Germany. Then he mixed his lies and hatred with fire and brimstone. Then the devil sat upon it. That's how Adolf was born. Now Adolf got the notion that he was the master race, and he swore he'd bring new order and put mankind in its place. So he set his scheme in motion and was winning everywhere, until he upped and got the notion for to kick that Russian bear.
Stalin wasn't stalling when he told the Beast of Berlin that they'd never rest contented till they had driven him from the land. So he called the Yanks and English and proceeded to extinguish the Fuhrer and his vermin. This is how it all began.
Yes, he kicked that noble Russian, but it wasn't very long before Adolf got suspicious that he had done something wrong. 'Cause that bear grabbed the Fuhrer and gave him an awful fight. 17 months he scrapped the Fuhrer, tooth and claw, day and night. Then that bear smacked the Fuhrer with a mighty armored paw, and Adolf broke all records running backwards to Krakow. Then Goebbels sent a message to the people everywhere that if they couldn't hit the Fuhrer, God done hit that Russian bear.
Stalin wasn't stalling when he told the Beast of Berlin that they'd never rest contented till they had driven him from the land. So he called the Yanks and English and proceeded to extinguish the Fuhrer and his vermin. This is how it all began.
Then this bear called on his buddy, the noble fighting Yank, and they set the Fuhrer running with their ships and planes and tanks. Now the Fuhrer's having nightmares, 'cause the Fuhrer knows darn well that the devil's done roast welcome on his presidency.
Stalin wasn't stalling when he told the Beast of Berlin that they'd never rest contented till they had driven him from the land. So he called the Yanks and English and proceeded to extinguish the Fuhrer and his vermin. This is how it all began.
This is Kristen Hirsch from Throwing Muses, and you're listening to a podcast released under a Creative Commons license.
Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Vibe, the host and producer of the Dr. Vibe Show at thedrvibeshow.com. At our show, we do conversations and provide information for black men and those who love them. So come check us out. Also at iTunes, and also selective episodes are featured at the Good Men Project, one of the most viewed websites in the world for men. So find out about black men and those who love them at the Dr. Vibe Show.
दोपहर को कहाँ गई थी?
दोपहर को बाजार गई थी।
पता क्यों नहीं जा सकती थी?
अरे अभी इसने क्या बताना?
पड़ोसियों से पता चलता है मुझे।
पता चले तो क्या हुआ?
चुप। ये घर मैं चलाता हूँ। मुझसे पूछे बगैर कोई काम नहीं होगा इस घर में। चल समझ।
घरेलू हिंसा में बाधा डालकर उसे रोको। बेल बजाओ। घरेलू हिंसा अधिनियम पर जानकारी के लिए bellbajao.org पर लॉग ऑन करें। ब्रेक थ्रू की पहल।
Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid from The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is APNS Public Radio.
I think Angry Indian is one of those people who likes to walk up to two guys and say, let's see you and him fight.
Okay, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. This is the Angry Indian, and we're speaking with American lawyer Stanley Cohen about what's happening in the United States and how the rise of fascism, how the rise of American fascism, this new version of American fascism, relates to what is happening in other places in the world, especially his particular space of knowledge in terms of what is happening in occupied Palestine. One of the things that I wanted to ask you, Brother Cohen, the situation in Palestine today, well, one of the things that I've written about has been the discovery of petroleum reserves and how Operation Cats led and how Pillar of Cloud and what have you, that these may have been covers for, you know, provide a legal background for taking all of this and denying the Palestinian Authority or the Hamas government, whoever is going to be recognized by the world authorities in terms of, you know, who this belongs to, in terms of revenue that can get the Palestinian people on their feet. That's the last time I dealt with things. But when I look at the news, I see, you know, water being denied to the people of Palestine. They have 2 hours of electricity a day in many cases. Black people in the United States, Native American people in the United States, Spanish-speaking Native American immigrants from south of the Rio Grande in the United States, and people from around the world, you know, working-class folks, can see the injustices of what is going on in Palestine. And whether it's an Obama government, whether it's a Bush government, one or two, whether it's a Trump government, you know, where are we to go in terms of our support for the people of Palestine when we're being accused of Judeophobia? It's very hard for me to explain to many people that some of the most fervent, most devoted, you know, in terms of, you know, principle, you know, human rights activism that is happening for Palestinian rights is happening actually in Israel. But when you're dealing in the United States, if you're Jewish, there's an assumption that you support the state of Israel politically, socially, economically, what they're doing to Palestinians and so on. But, you know, what is the average American supposed to do when faced with this sort of repression at home? Well, we're supposed to be a country that defends human rights when we have clear human rights violations happening in Palestine, where we can relate these to what is happening to people of color here in North America.
Well, look, there has been a fundamental systemic disconnect from day one in this country. You know, a country which in theory was based upon freedom, which was driven by independence from the crown and religious freedom. And it's also interesting, people don't realize that one of the largest initial, aside from Protestants that arrived, that had been here, that were fighting against the church, or different brands, for lack of a better word, of Christianity, against the crown, one of the largest early religions in the United States was Islam, because huge numbers, hundreds of thousands of, in the early days of people in North America, forgetting about for a moment North American Indians, were slaves from Africa, many of whom were Muslims. And when you bring this up, people are stunned because of this notion that Islam has suddenly become a growing or developing or a present religion in this country, which in fact was here from the 1600s. But to get back to your point, I have taken a position. Look, I represented for 20 years one of the attorneys of the political wing of Hamas, and I represented directly the head of the political wing of Hamas for a long time. I've represented numerous Palestinian activists, political activists, largely with the Islamic resistance movement. I've sued Israel. I'm banned from Israel at this point. So I've been involved in the Palestinian struggle and resistance for many years. And independent of whatever my advice may or may not have been at times to my clients, and whatever role I did or did not play, and certainly Zionists enjoy running the fantasy flag up the pole on how, you know, Cohen is a member of the inner circle of Hamas, a Jewish anarchist from New York City, my position on resistance for the West has been clear. The decision of how the nature and extent of resistance on the ground in Palestine is left to Palestinians. You know, it's this notion that we hear among progressive Jews and progressive leftists who are not Jews in the United States and the West, that there must be peaceful resistance. That, you know, I can support peace and I can support nonviolence and I can support, you know, Martin Luther King tactics in Palestine may give people comfort, but it's not our call to make. The nature and extent of the resistance in Palestine is up to Palestinians, first and foremost, on the ground. And second, those Palestinians of whom there are, I don't know, 7 million, 11 million, I keep losing count now, in the diaspora. What we can do in the West is we can support the BDS movement, which is a Palestinian design. It's a Palestinian call for economic, artistic, business, educational boycotts of Israel to make sure that Israelis understand it's not business as usual, that as long as there is an occupation, an ethnic cleansing, and apartheid, it's not business as usual. And that's the way that we can break the back of Zionism and break the back of the Israeli state. So I've had this debate for many, many years among people that, well, it should go this way, it should go that way, it should be this, it should not be. That's not our call. As a sign of solidarity, as a sign of brother and sisterhood, what we can do is we can engage in demonstrations, we can engage in passive and peaceful resistance or militant resistance in the United States in whatever way we want. We can support BDS. And it's the same claim that our position I've taken on domestic resistance by people of color, by women, by members of LGBT, August, by members of LGBTQ. These are calls to be made based upon the nature of the oppression locally, based upon changing priorities and changing expectations. And while obviously I support the right of self-determination worldwide, I defer to the ultimate decision on the nature and extent of self-determination to indigenous struggles on the ground worldwide. We have this notion, you know, it's interesting. There are so many raving conspiracy theories in the United States right now. Left conspiracy, right conspiracy. One of them that disturbs me the most is this notion that, you know, that the Arab Spring, Arab resistance, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Nusri, whoever it is Western-founded, Western-funded, and Western-directed. Implicit in this notion is the fact of it's the exceptionalism of the West that can only ignite a spark, a drive for resistance, for self-determination, for freedom, to develop the capacity to resist, to fight. Implicit in this is this arrogance of the West that we and we alone can direct, can fund, can found, can further resistance movements in communities of color outside the United States. Arab culture, Palestinian life, people in Africa, in the West, in the North, in South Africa, are folks that have been involved in paying heavy prices of colonialism and neocolonialism for generations. They know what the nature of the beast is. They know how they wish to resist and struggle. That doesn't mean that the fact that a resistance movement of color, such as Boko Haram, gets a free pass because it's a resistance movement of color, that ISIS, because it's a movement of Arab resistance, which in fact wasn't founded and formed and funded by the United States, but broke off of Al-Qaeda, was expelled from Al-Qaeda in 2003 in Iraq. And this isn't, you know, open to debate. I've been involved in the Middle East for 25 years. While activists in the West like to create and promote this notion, they were expelled by Abu Muqdisi because of attacks on civilians and because of certain other violations. So, again, you know, and people confuse my difficulty with, you know, the conspiracy theories as if to say, well, you're supporting Western imperialism. You're supporting, you know, the Western decision on how people in the Middle East or Africa choose to fight where and when. And it's quite the opposite. I reject the notion that people in the Middle East, people in the Gulf, people in Africa, people in Asia need, quote, the deep state in the United States to tell them who and where to fight and how and when. Are there examples where there is a convergence or where there are governments in those regions that are proxies of the West? Of course. Look at the Gulf right now. The GCC is largely comprised of proxies that do the bidding of the United States and long have. They were founded and fomented by imperial design 150 years ago. But this arrogance that comes out of exceptionalism in the United States, that it is for us a 250-year-old experiment to dictate the aspirations, the endeavors, the struggle, and the goals of cultures, societies, communities, and worlds thousands of years old is nothing short of rank exceptionalism at its core, racism.
All right, well, let me ask you, where is the Syrian Defense Forces, the SDF and the YPG and the Women's Revolution in Rojava? How does this fit into this? Because, you know, the SDF is supported by the United States, but the YGP is also supported by the United States. But then Turkey has been contesting this, and there's been shots fired between the Kurds and Turkey. And we remember when the entire Iraq, then Afghanistan thing started under the Bush administration, or Bush the second administration anyway. The news that we got here in the West, at least the European news, reported that the U.S. made it very clear to the Kurds that they would not have an independent state. They would never realize territorial ambitions of a Kurdistan. Even though those of us who have been paying attention to the news know it's the Kurds that have been fighting Daesh and losing people to Daesh. The women have stood up Daesh without the men and started. They actually led the revolution to begin with, unless I'm getting false information. And then you have Iran who has been fighting Daesh. You have Hamas and Hezbollah that have been fighting Daesh. I believe they've even lost commanders to Daesh assassinations. You know, there's a lot of confusion here about what colonialism is, what independence is. And before you give me an answer, I want to read off a couple of things here for some of the listeners. The United Nations has passed at least two resolutions that are figuring into my questions here. The Declaration on the Granting of Independence to Colonial Countries and Peoples, which was adopted by the UN General Assembly on the 14th of December 1960, discusses this issue. So does the Genocide Conventions, the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide in 1948. The United States is not full signatory to either of these conventions. So when we look at Rojava, and we look at everything that you've been talking about, and then we look at Occupy Palestine, then we look at the situation of, you know, Indian country, Native America, then we look at what Black Lives Matter is talking about, where they don't want to you know, we don't want to be separate from the United States, but we want respect within the United States. How do these international laws figure into resistance and the choice of resistance or the methods that are decided by a community in which they will defend themselves or stand up for themselves?
Well, look, you hit it right at the head. I mean, you didn't include the Rome Statute, which remains the primary vehicle, although it's been used largely against people of color. The United States is not a signatory to the Rome Statute, which is the ICC. Russia is not a signatory to the ICC. Israel is not a signatory to the ICC, although it strategically elected to, in theory, although I expect it still believes it can renounce findings, to weigh in, because when Palestine got observer status, it generated their ability to sign the Rome Statute, and so now the ICC has jurisdiction. You've named struggles that are difficult for me, and I'm not trying to avoid or evade answers, because Syria is the perfect example. I get accused by folks that are supporting Assad of being opposed to Assad. I get accused by people that are opposed to Assad of supporting Assad. I have friends and comrades and colleagues on both sides. What's now morphed into probably four sides of what's going on in Syria. I have represented people for years in the region, Syria, in Lebanon, in Turkey. I've represented people involved in Kurdistan. The notion that, and I recently wrote a piece where I got a lot of heat when I thought it was rather sophomoric, which strongly supported Qatar, and I have strongly supported Qatar for years, because of my first-hand involvement with the state and what I've seen it's what it has engaged in and done, not just in public but in private, which is often something that is implicated by representing leaders and movements and players, that things aren't in the public eye and can't be discussed. If you get back to the fundamental question about if anyone who is counting on international fiat to provide a sense of your power, legitimacy, or justice, need only look at 1948 and Palestine. Much to his credit, Truman said, look, I've got American Jews and Zionists that are voters that have a lot of money that are pouring it into me, importing into the U.S., and I'm supporting them. Not that it makes him a hero, but at least he was honest on that point. I don't look to international covenants or treaties for much of anything other than when it was successful in South Africa because of international sanctions, and I suspect that's where it's going in Palestine. I ultimately believe that events on the ground are determined by events on the ground. It can often be ugly and painful, and it can be very confusing, because I can sit here and easily cite you chapter and verse of lots of events on the ground in the region that violate international law on both sides. People create, and I have in the past served as an advisor to the Assad government, not for a number of years, but have. And I represented Osama bin Laden's son-in-law. I've done other cases involving Al-Qaeda in Nusra. I was involved with ISIS or Daesh when it came down to trying to negotiate for the release of a hostage. So I've got a pretty good handle on the area. But one of the problems is we tend to force ourselves into certain boxes when it comes to resistance. So there are people that will completely whitewash the fact that thousands, tens of thousands of Syrians have been imprisoned and tortured, women subjected to rape over many years. They will forget about events in 1982 on the ground. Because they choose Assad. On the other hand, I'm not going to minimize the fact that the Assad government has been one of the strongest governments in support of the resistance against Israel and its colonial design in the region. I have long been a supporter of Iran and Hezbollah. I've represented both at various times in different capacities. I am not a fan of Russia, as I am not obviously a fan of the United States.
neither of whom have any connection to the region other than an attempt to exploit resources. You started this round pointing out the natural gas fields off the coast of Gaza, which, you know, I can envision Exxon and Israel and the United States carving up Gaza, investing billions of dollars. There's been some discussion now of the development of an island off the coast of Gaza into a retreat, a luxury retreat, and would serve as employment for Palestinians. You've got 85% of the natural water, the resources in the West Bank, in violation of international law, stolen by Israel, providing water not just to the classic quote-unquote settlers, but also to Israel proper, for lack of a better word. So if there is one constant, it is a colonial design that focuses on resources in the region. Let's not forget the developing world is just that. It is untapped. It is developing its own course and its own future. But let us also not, and look, I'm not suggesting that people should not take principled stances. And I'm not suggesting that people should ignore the realities of some very ugly events on both sides. But I also believe it is naive, and to some degree arrogant for Westerners to impose a narrow and rigid view of events on the ground overseas that they have no first-hand involvement with or knowledge of. And I have, you know, taken some heat for that. Recently being attacked for supporting quote-unquote right-wing Islamic fundamentalist groups in the region by someone who belongs to a very narrow and small and entitled, for lack of a better word, sect. This is a word that he or she has used in the context of sectarian. I recently was lectured by a journalist who, you know, he comes from the rubble of Boston College, as is another journalist who comes from the dangerous roads of Virginia, about positions to take about good and bad in the Middle East. I defer to folks on the ground in the Middle East. It is their nation, it is their future, it is their belief, and it is their call. One of the main reasons why we see the humanitarian crisis that we now see is because for far too long, either directly or through proxy states, we've tried to carve up and have carved up the region to further our own cultural, economic, and resources and drive. You know, the issue of Turkey and what may or may not be Kurdistan, the issue of the breakdown in Iraq, Syria no longer exists in my view. You have Damascus and the rest of it is in ruin. There's already discussions of Russia having a permanent presence there. The U.S. is negotiating in their own way to have a presence there. There is clearly this tension that is not recent. 6 or 7 years ago, I was asked at the start of the Syrian civil war, and I get tremendous blow pushback by people when I use the phrase civil war, because implicit in that is the notion that there's a possibility that large segments of a society which is 82% Sunni and controlled by 10% Alawite for 50 years might have some tension. But I was asked to, I was in, doing a keynote address in a conference in Lebanon, and I was asked to come to Syria to meet with some people. And I urged folks at the time that I thought the only way to stave off what has now unfortunately come to pass was a government of national consensus, a government where people of all backgrounds, faiths, traditions and histories would have a prominent say in the development of the future. It didn't happen. And what began very clearly as a resistance, a peaceful resistance movement, and developed into a militant civil war, was very quickly overrun by the agendas of countries and players outside the region and inside the region. It's difficult. Whole region is.
You're well versed in the human rights issues in terms of, for what we've been, you know, by a limited time here, you know, in terms of Palestinians, We talked about Africans here, and of course the indigenous situation of Native Americans is, you know, related to what's happening in Palestine. It's directly related as far as we're concerned. But there are people who will ask, well, okay, you spoke to Stanley Cohen, and, you know, he's discussed these particular issues, but, you know, we're friends, and you know I'm gay. Iran is not particularly friendly towards, you know, people like me. Many of the Arab nations in which he's represented certain politicians' personalities are not particularly keen on people like me. They will acknowledge, for example, that under Ayatollah Khomeini, I believe it was, that he recognized transgender people under Islam. I forget the exact reasoning behind that. And they found that to be progressive. I understand their current leader is not, he's like, this is not something that we really need to be worried about. You know, we need to understand a little bit more. But, you know, there are questions like that for a lot of people on what is considered the progressive left in the United States on how can you not support what we consider to be liberty and freedoms over here and not really speak to those issues, but pick and choose, say, colonialism issues, imperialism, but not the day-to-day suffering, say, that some people might endure, like, say, women in a lot of these societies. If you could just speak to that for me.
Well, it presupposes one major position, that I have been silent about human rights anywhere in the world. I have a very clear and very public position on human rights and gender identification, sexual preference, the role of women. I have very publicly for 40 years taken a position that hasn't changed. What I think you have to understand, though, is that I have to often walk a very sensitive, you know, I have to walk a tightrope with what I do in the Middle East often. And there are lots of people presuppose what I say or what I do and the role that I've played and the people I talk to and what my advice or counsel has been at any given time on any given issue. And I guess folks will have to wait for the book or for the eulogy to get the full story. The notion that, you know, that women, now I'm not going to disagree with you that the lesbian, gay, and transgender community has suffered tremendous oppression, not just certainly in the West, but certainly in parts of Africa, in the Middle East, and the Gulf. And those are issues that are developing and emerging that I have confidence will change and evolve as governments and people change and society changes. The notion that women as a mass group are oppressed among what 1.8 billion people, Muslims, is something that is sold by the West. You know, the notion that we invaded Afghanistan to protect women is silly. Some of the most dynamic, powerful, and empowered people in the entire Middle East and in Africa I've ever dealt with are women. People that make life and death decisions every day of the week. Choose whether they're going to, if they're Muslim, wear hijab or not wear hijab. People who are members of governments, who are members of movements. Look, there's ignorance. There's incredible ignorance. You know, and it's interesting because you on several occasions have brought up, you know, Native American communities. And, you know, I've represented Native American communities for 30 years. My partner over 20, you know, everyone is 1/16th Cherokee, it seems. But my partner over 20 years is a Mohawk from Agwazasne. So it's not some of my best friends are. I've lived in the Iroquois Confederacy for decades. I'm, you know, adopted by the Bear Clan. It's a matriarchal society. And there is a very close connection between Islam and traditional Indian, particularly the longhouse of the Iroquois Confederacy, where there is no separation between family politics, religion, belief practices, life, and attitudes. It's all one fist, fingers connected. So the notion that, you know, that women as a class are entirely oppressed, exploited, and powerless throughout the Middle East or throughout the Gulf or throughout Africa, plays more often than not into a nice, sweet, and tight colonial agenda. Now, I'm not going to say that in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, one of the United States' closest allies right now, and has slaughtered tens of thousands of people in Yemen with American guns and planes right now, that women have a position of power. They don't. Clearly don't. On the other hand, there are states in the Gulf where women are empowered and equal. I have many, many, you know, I hate to say it, some of my best friends are women in the Middle East that are very powerful, that are involved in decision-making and in the Native American communities, Longhouse communities. Women are empowered to protect and control and dictate the land. It's not so different in other parts of the world. So, you know, to those friends of yours who want to know what Stanley Cohen's position is on, you know, how can Stanley Cohen support indigenous movements, indigenous struggles, government states are serving that capacity where there are other degrees of exploitation or human rights violation? Well, there's a very simple answer, as I said, is A, don't assume positions that I take or do not take with clients or friends or in communities. And B, if Stanley Cohen is going to have to be an effective advocate, an effective human rights activist, an effective lawyer, it's not for me to go into a community. Just the way I started this discussion by saying, it's not for the West determined to dictate to the Middle East or Africa the nature and extent of the resistance and when to fight who and how. It's not for Stanley Cohen to show up into tribal regions and to start dictating what is or is not acceptable, what is norm and what is not. I've learned over almost half a century of resistance and struggle domestically and internationally, often the best way to influence or to help in shaping or massaging policies and attitudes is to live your life, be yourself, and express your opinion openly and candidly on all subjects. And I've never felt the need to be silent on any issue. That's been my life for decades, and whether I have 3 years or 30 years left, it'll stay that way.
Okay, and, you know, one of my final questions, you know, is on the religious aspect, because even though I don't particularly practice a, you know, religious faith, discipline, what have you, my neighbors do. And they tend to base a lot of their opinions on these things. My fellow countrymen tend to base a lot of their opinions, all of their politics on this, and many, many conflicts around the world. So one of the really jaundiced, you know, perspectives that we have here in North America is that Islam somehow represents violence. Now, even though I can point out the fact that 96 to 98% of the terrorist acts that have occurred in the continental United States have been because of Christian far-right, you know, terrorists. I mean, there is nothing else to call them, whether it's the Army of God, whether it's a neo-Nazi organization, splinter group, whether it's one of these William Pierce inspired Turner Diary lone wolves that are going out and doing their own thing. The blame that is placed on religion in terms of explaining away violence, in terms of justifying violence, hate, discrimination, racialism. What do you feel as a lawyer, you know, given your perspective and your ability to be objective, can the left learn from the international community and how to really be able to deal with this effectively instead of just simply saying, well, you hate and you're ignorant? You know, how can people really make a logical, a superficial?
Well, look, if people are concerned about the nexus between religion and violence, they need to look at the 100 million Latin American, North American, South American, Central American Indians that were murdered by Christians and missionaries. We seem to overlook that. If people are disturbed over the nexus between religious practice and supremacy, and violence of international law and domestic policy and justice, we need to remember that the U.S. Constitution, which has slaves as 3/5 human beings, was passed by largely a Protestant the majority of white men that control the country and to some extent still do. My position is simple. And I've recently told people, I don't want to hear the phrase Islamic terrorism, Islamic fundamentalism, or Wahhabism, or any of these isms, because it feeds into the haters. Islam is a religion of almost 2 billion people. I've spent a lot of time in the heart of Islam, 30 years. While I've not been to Mecca, I've been invited, and I wasn't supposed to be, but I didn't go. I've been to Al-Aqsa, I've been to Medina, I've been to Islamic communities in Africa, in the north of Africa, in the south of Africa. There are 2 billion Muslims in this world. It is a beautiful, peaceful religion. Boko Haram and ISIS or Daesh is not Islam. The Sunni lunatics, as I call them, in Saudi Arabia right now, while they are the protectors of Mecca, is not Islam. You know, people have to come to grips. It's interesting that when we build alliances as leftists, as political, as activists, as anarchists, we take a look at the whole person and we avoid stereotypical relationships or conclusions. We do that. But yet we fall prey to oversimplification and stereotypes, especially when we're hit with it by mainstream media every day. There are people, just as I very clearly have distinguished between Judaism and Israel and Zionism, I distinguish between a very small percentage of Muslims that are involved in violation of international law and human rights. And I think they've walked far away from Islam. And I say the same thing about Jews. And I say the same things about Christians. And I say the same things about, look at what's going on in Myanmar, where you have, you know, the Dalai Lama speaks beautiful, wonderful thoughts, but he seems to be quiet when it comes to what's going on in with Muslims. You know, historically, we have these notions that are often based upon political conclusions. So my response to the left of my youth, which no longer exists, and I'm glad perhaps because it got a little bit too doctrinaire and doctrinal for me down the road, is that we have to, and this sounds perhaps even a little bit too kumbaya, which I've used a few times in this interview, we have to judge people and movements for who they are and what they are and how they live, not what they say. I have been very close to some extraordinarily influential Islamic scholars and political leaders and activists. I have been in the heart of Islam for decades. And my position has been and remains, it is a beautiful religion. Look, I'm a you know, it's interesting. I'm a direct descendant in Judaism of Moses and Aaron. If you follow the religion of my parents, I'm a direct descendant. So when people ask me, you know, where did I stray? I laugh and say they were the penultimate iconoclasts. So I'm just following in my genetic trait. I'm not a believer, but I do respect the faith of others. I respect it, and that does not mean that I'm removed from being judgmental when I believe it becomes an excuse for outrage, when it subjugates others, when it, you know, the notion of wartime brides, whether it's Boko Haram or Daesh or Israel. What are we talking about here? The notion that one class, gender, race of people is superior to the to another on the basis of their belief or their position or their faith is an anathema to human rights and to humanity and international law. And that's my position. I don't know if I've answered the question, but I am disturbed over what I see to be growing trends among the left in the United States to fall for this Islamist fundamentalist trap, which I see being perpetrated by people that have a unique political agenda. Are there people that are Muslim that are involved in damning struggle, in outrages? Absolutely. But I am not prepared to write 2 billion people off
because of the offenses of a handful of them. And the left needs to, you know, there are journalists out there right now, it doesn't matter who they are, like I read pieces periodically that fall into this stereotypical general overview notion of, you know, Islamic fundamentalism and Islamic terrorism. It almost becomes a talismanic chant, that is rooted in this notion of, you know, the good Arab, the good Jew, the good gay, the bad gay, which if you are committed to human rights, if you are committed to the dignity of the individual, is a fundamental distortion.
I agree, because even in the black community, in the past 10 years or so, there's been a reliance on everything. If they don't fix the traffic light within 3 days, well, you know, it's white supremacy. You know, I fell down the stairs, white supremacy. And, you know, it's under the idea that somehow if white racialism in the Anglophone world was to disappear tomorrow, that there would just be equality across the board. And then when I mentioned Rwanda, when I mentioned, like you talked about, the Rohingya people in Myanmar, that Aung San Suu Kyi has not seen fit to mention anything about human rights, personality. It can't be that simple. And I agree with you. I believe that those of us that consider ourselves to be on the left, whatever the manifestation of, you know, of the left we subscribe to or think we subscribe to anyway, we do tend to see the human being, tend to see the human family as a whole. And we try to look at things holistically. And, you know, I can't prove this, but, you know, I'm of the mind that many people on the left, especially in the United States, in some ways have become very comfortable. And, you know, they just simply cannot accept that the Klan would really step back to their 1950s, 1960s persona and do what happened in Charlottesville, even though they were talking about using vehicle attacks a month before the event. Even though President Trump and every other Republican has been talking about the use of cars as a terrorist tactic in Europe. But far right has started to use that in North America, and this is not considered terrorism. I mean, as a lawyer, what do you have to say about that?
Look. My answer is the ADL. You know, people cherry pick terrorism. It's a label that's thrown around. You know, if it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it smells like a duck, it's a duck. Terrorism is very simple. I mean, it's interesting because the one area of, although I disagree with it dramatically, I mean, I've probably defended more terrorism, real and fake cases, the last 20, 25 years in the United States than any other defense attorney in the country. And there is a clear definition of what it is and what it ain't, and what the government needs to prove and what it does not. And it is very simple in my mind, although it doesn't match the federal, you know, the federal standard ultimately is acts carried out, and it could be any number of acts to try to alter the policy illegally, to alter the policy of a government or the government. You know, terrorism to me is very simple. Terrorism to me is acts that are directed at cognizable groups, at minorities, at religious, at racial creeds, at sexual groups, at political groups that are designed to attack, to punish, to penalize them for their identity of who they are and to send a message. That's terrorism. You know, I don't need to, you know, this notion, and I tried to explain it to people later. You know, there's been this big push all of a sudden among some on the left that they want to have hate crimes. You know, they want to get groups, you know, participation, allegiance, membership in a group designated as a crime. You know, they always talk about the Klan, or they talk about neo-Nazi groups, and then they forget about Black Lives Matter, or they forget about Antifa, and they forget about leftist groups. You know, the way it works in New York State, there are hate crimes, but they're traditional crimes. If you get convicted of an assault, you get convicted of a murder, you get convicted of an arson, that's what you are prosecuted for. And then, as an aside, if there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt that it was motivated by a recognized animus based upon, you know, traditional classes, cognizable minorities, that's where there's an enhanced sentence.
It doesn't get involved in classifying groups. That's what we tried to do and did do, and there's still the alien sedition laws in New York State in the books 100 years later. That's what we tried to do in response to the anarchist movement and to the abolitionist movement and post-abolitionist period in the United States. And it was a failure. And it ended up being used as a political tool. So for me, the definition of terrorism, I don't need to have, no luck. You know, people got offended because to this day, the president has still not denounced a clear act of terrorism, that most recent firebombing of a masjid, of a mosque in Minnesota. And people are offended by it. I don't need official designations, official prosecutions. As an activist, as a human being, we are all prepared to take a look at circumstances and see what is an act of terrorism and what is not. I'll give you a perfect example. You know, you had that young Israeli kid who turned out to be a total wingnut, who from Israel was calling in all these bomb scares to synagogues all over the United States and Jewish community centers. And it created this tremendous fear in the Jewish community. It was just after the election of Trump, and it was the first sort of signpost of quote-unquote anti-Semitism, although, again, I don't know how Ashkenazi Jews are Semites. And it turned out at the end of the day that, I don't know, 30, 40, 50, 60% of these calls, whatever they were done by an Israeli who I believe is also an American Jew, a young 17 or 18-year-old kid who had some really serious mental health issues happen. Was it terrorism? I don't know. I mean, did it terrorize communities? Absolutely. Or was it a delusional act of someone with some mental health issues? I've had more than a few so-called terrorism cases in the United States where confidential informants and FBI agents infiltrated one or two or three young Muslim kids, 18, 19, 20-year-old kids, and African Americans with mental health issues that were recognizable, that led them, walked them, talked them, set them up, and then busted them for terrorism. Is it terrorism? Of course not. But under the law, it is. So I think we have to distinguish, as a sophisticated, I'd like to think, society, between stings, political resistance and struggle, between mental health issues, and between identifying hate. When it comes to what happened in Charlottesville, the notion that there are good people that were out there carrying torches and chanting what they were chanting, that there were good people. Well, you know, maybe in the circle that President Trump runs in, they're good people. The notion or the attempt to criminalize or, quote, terrorize Antifa for principled and militant and fierce resistance in defense of communities and values and principle is something that historically there's been too little resistance, not enough. So I guess we end up where we started.
Where else besides Counterpunch can folks find your written pieces?
I've got a lot of pieces on Al Jazeera. I actually had an interesting piece on Al Jazeera recently. My last one, which is, you know, the Palestinians have a right to armed struggle, which is a piece about which talks about international law, which, you know, has pissed off a lot of people. I've probably, in the last year, written, I don't know, 10 or 15 pieces that have been fairly popular for Al Jazeera and also Counterpunch. And, you know, antiwar.com has done stuff. I'm about to have published in mid-September in the Gulf, in English and Arabic, in Newsweek Gulf, a very long piece, some 7,000-word piece in two sections. You know, I've been around.
Well, hey, you've been listening to Stanley Cohen, U.S. lawyer, political activist, international human rights advocate, and American citizen. Brother Cohen, thank you for coming on. I really appreciated this.
Do me a favor. Keep up the fabulous posts I see you. I'm following you that I see from you. And take care.
All right.
Take care, brother. Take care. Bye-bye.
Peace. This has been Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please, stay tuned.
Listen to Angry Indian Radio. He is not only for Indians, but he is also for blacks and other minorities. And they have done a lot on the problems in Palestine and also the problems of blacks. And so I recommend that you listen to them.
Many arguments against the death penalty. It's not a deterrent against the crimes that it punishes. Society who use the death penalty don't have lower crime rates than those that do. When a country abolishes the death penalty, they are not plunged into criminal chaos. But even if the death penalty did reduce crime rates, would it then be acceptable? The death penalty targets the economically disadvantaged, those who can't afford good legal counsel, those without a voice in society. There's a saying in the US, capital punishment means that those without the capital get the punishment. Statistics show this is true. But would it be acceptable if people from all sections of society were executed? Does killing a rich man make killing a poor man right? The death penalty is irreversible and results in the death of innocence. When someone is dead, a retrospective pardon is of little use to them or their family. Since 1990, in China, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and the USA, there have been 51 recorded executions of child offenders, some as young as 14 years old. But even if no more innocents or children are killed, should we tolerate the death penalty? The death penalty is never acceptable. It abuses two of our most basic human rights. Everyone has the right to live, and no one shall be subject to torture. The death penalty obviously kills people, but it also tortures, physically by the brutal nature of execution, and psychologically by forcing individuals to wait to be killed. They wait, sometimes for decades, while others are led to their deaths. The horror of this waiting is unimaginable. Human rights are thus called because they apply to all human beings. They belong to all of us equally. An attack on these fundamental rights anywhere is an attack against all of us. The right to life is inalienable. It cannot be given and it cannot be taken away. No matter how terrible the crime, in a world full of uncertainty, human rights are a clearly drawn line, a line between what is right and what is wrong, the line between imprisonment and execution. Every individual facing the death penalty is, whatever they stand accused of, still a human being. However much we revile them, however much we are outraged by their actions, however much we want revenge, they are still human beings. They may well have killed and tortured. They've crossed the line. But do we really want to join them?
Yo, what's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying? For Men in Hip Hop, really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable. You know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about. It shouldn't be supported. You know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today and said what he said, you know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers, attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. It's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
I would like anyone who is listening to consider some thoughts that I paraphrase from the words of German pastor Martin Niemöller. You might not care if Donald Trump says Muslims must register with their government because you're not one. And you might not care if Donald Trump says he's going to round up all the Hispanic immigrants because you're not one. And you might not care if Donald Trump says it's okay to rough up black protesters because you're not one. And you might not care if Donald Trump wants to suppress journalists because you're not one. But think about this. If he keeps going and he actually becomes president, he might just get around to you. And you better hope that there's someone left to help you.
Hello. This is a message to the so-called New Black Panther Party, which resides in the United States of America. As an American citizen, I ask that you all immediately disband and stop what you are doing, which is misrepresenting an organization and a culture that you do not understand. As the child of a Black Panther, I was raised to understand that the ideals of a Black Panther shall live on. However, the physical representation of a Black Panther can and will be oftentimes misrepresented and imitated. These gentlemen are Black Panthers, and they also have the original mindset of Black Panther, which is to ensure truth, justice, and equality for every single tax-paying American citizen, regardless of the color of their skin or their ethnicity. God bless you, and power to the people.
I'm so thirsty for revolution. I'm so crazy about the people. We're going to stand together. We're going to have a black army, a Mexican-American army, an alliance in solidarity. We're going to have some progressive whites, all of us. And we're going to march on this pig power structure, and we're going to say, stick them up, motherfucker. We come for what's ours. Up against the wall. Power to the people. Thanks, brother.
Asada, terrorist or survivor of terrorism. With the news of the posting of an additional $850,000 for the return of former Black Panther and Black Liberation Army member Asata Shakur from Cuba, the U.S. government has taken another step in its ridiculous so-called war on terrorism. They did this by New Jersey officials branding Asata with the latest libelous label, terrorist, in an attempt to justify this modern-day slave bounty. If anybody knows about terrorism, it's Americans, for this nation was founded in terrorism. So deep is this truth that it lies in the subconscious of almost every American and can be unleashed with unnerving ease. Come on, complete this phrase. The only good Indian is a blank. Black, white, rich, or poor, that phrase echoes in American consciousness, an inheritance from a time when those dark thoughts were dark realities of, yes, genocide against the native peoples that fed and healed the starving settlers from Europe who survived the Atlantic crossings. Terrorism, white terrible violence against red life and black life and brown life and yellow life. That is America's truest hidden history, hidden beneath lies about all men are created equal. In 1973, when Asata Shakur and Zaid Malik Shakur and Sundiata Akoli were stopped on the New Jersey Turnpike, they weren't stopped because the cops wanted to render assistance. This was a car stop for the unwritten crime of driving while black before we developed the term, and the cops tried to kill every Black Panther in that car for this unwritten crime. Zaid was shot to death, and Asata was shot twice. And in an act of arrogance that only American judicial terrorists can devise, she was charged with murdering both Zaid and the cop that tried to kill her. Asada went through a devil's brew of show trials in several states, best summed up in a book by her lawyer aunt, Evelyn Williams, titled Inadmissible Evidence. These were trials that seemed more fitting for Mississippi than Middlesex County, New Jersey, or Manhattan Borough, New York. But no matter where that happened, they featured all-white juries and ambitious judges who didn't even pretend to be fair and unbiased arbiters. Even despite these obvious obstructions, she was acquitted. And when she was convicted in Middlesex, it was clear this was a verdict not of her guilt, but of her political ideas. To label this woman a terrorist is to bleed all meaning from the word. For during her life as an activist, during her wounding at her arrest, and during her travails as an accused in courtrooms that were more lynching posts than halls of justice, she was terrorized by a system that wanted to punish her for daring to rebel. These words are written on May 13th, 2005, 20 years to the day from the police mass murder and bombing of the Move Home in Philadelphia. Today, 20 years later, only one person, Ramona Africa, ever spent a day in jail. What of those cops who shot and bombed unarmed children? What of the politicians who unleashed these dogs of urban war? Like Ramona, Asada was jailed for daring to survive. Cuba's valiant Fidel Castro responded almost immediately to announce his refusal to recognize this modern-day slave bounty. He pronounced her a political prisoner during her time in American gulags, perhaps remembering that she was held in an all-male jail during her incarceration. For centuries, nothing has so stirred up American fury like the escape of a slave. That ain't just distant history. For daring to slip her bonds and escape from brutal and unjust bondage, the empire now labels her a terrorist. That's because to them, nothing is more terrifying than resistance to their imperial will. As for terrorists, if they really want to find some, it shouldn't be too hard to find them. Just check the White House. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
And the Democrats are throwing the election away. For what? An inadequate black male? Who would not have been running had it not been a white woman that was running for president. I'm no second-class citizen. And God damn the Democrats.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Now, we did hear later that all of the facilities, all of the refineries went into voluntary shutdown mode. And when that happens, they often have to go through the process of burning off these excess chemicals. But it's a dirty burn. So you can see actually the black smoke. Unfortunately, that adds thousands of pounds of cancer-causing chemicals to the air.
Unprecedented, historic, apocalyptic. These are the words being used to describe Hurricane Harvey, which has caused the largest rainfall in continental U.S. history. We will go to Houston to get